America. Live, this is Point of View. And now, Kirby Anderson.
And welcome to Point of View. Today we're going to spend some time really talking about masculinity, how to look at that from a biblical point of view. And I think you would have to agree, if you've listened to some of the programs we've done, we're really facing a crisis in this regard. Dr. William Farrell's been on the program where we talked about the boy crisis, and certainly a crisis in mental health. As a matter of fact, as we will talk about next hour, a very good article I've posted on why American lifespans are getting shorter, and a good portion of that has to do with some of the mental health issues with young men. And certainly if you start looking at such issues as car accidents, gun violence, obesity, deaths of despair, that's certainly significant. Of course, economic as well. There always has been an assumption that the next generation will do better than the previous one, but that hasn't necessarily worked out as well. And part of that has to do with education, because after all, we've talked about the fact that with the advent of feminism really wanting to lift women, which I think was a very positive and necessary thing, now the genders have reversed themselves. We've gone from a time in the last 50 years where females went to actually receive college degrees at about 39% to 61%. Males have dropped from 61% to 39%. They've completely reversed. And of course, if you start thinking about what that means long term in terms of fathering, and if indeed they're struggling with what it means to be masculine, that's going to be an issue of how they actually parent their own children. And it isn't just young boys. I mean, we're recognizing now young men. You've heard me give the statistics before from Nicholas Eberstadt, pointing out that right now we have about 7 million men ages 25 to 54 who are not working and are not looking for work. And just put that in perspective, the best estimates are we have about anywhere from 10 million to 11 million unfilled jobs. And yet we find that that is another very important issue as well. So in the past, of course, trying to address this in the secular world, they've tried to address it with a men's movement, the Christian world with the Promise Keepers, and many other things we'll talk about. But there is certainly a crisis, if you want to think about it, in terms of thinking biblically about what it means to be masculine, which is why we're going to spend some time today talking with Zachary Wagner. He is a researcher, ordained minister, an individual right now living in Oxford, England, and pursuing a doctorate of philosophy in New Testament. Also is the editorial director of the Center for Pastoral Theologians. This is his first book, Non-Toxic Masculinity, Recovering Healthy Male Sexuality. And so, Zachary, thank you for joining us today here on Point of View.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kirby. I'm delighted to be with you and looking forward to the conversation.
You know, one thing I also left out and just occurred to me, when you even hear the phrase toxic masculinity, that's another problem for the church, because the people outside the church are saying, well, you guys that believe the Bible, well, they're reinforcing patriarchy, and even your biblical ideas are toxic masculinity. So I really feel sorry for the younger individuals, yourself and even people younger than you, trying to figure out what it means to be a man in the 21st century.
Yeah, it seems to me, I mean, just listening to even you describe that crisis, I fully resonate with that. And I think it extends not only from within the church, but well without and outside of it. And, you know, in recent years, I think there's this broader cultural conversation, and toxic, you know, toxic has become a general buzzword, I suppose. But even fixated on men in this kind of phrase of toxic masculinity, I think that does create even well-meaning men and boys who don't want to be living out their masculinity in a way that is harmful to others. It creates, I think, some anxiety and confusion about, well, what does it mean to live as a man in a way that is respectful to others and, of course, honoring to God? And I genuinely think we are in a moment, as, you know, the church's slice of this broader cultural crisis, where there aren't a lot of really clear answers as to what that might look like. So I hope my project can be a small part in being part of the solution there, and you know, pushing the conversation in a helpful and healthy direction.
I just mentioned that we are going to have Nancy Piercy on. She has a book coming out this month.
Oh, yes.
The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. So in some respects, I'm not expecting you to solve all the problems here today. We'll leave that to her. But
yeah,
nevertheless, it does illustrate the fact that we are dealing with a difficulty, because if people even say, well, I'll look to Jesus. Well, okay, which Jesus do we look at? Because oftentimes people focus on one. Jesus, who's talking about, consider the lilies of the field. And then later on, you see him confronting the Pharisees for their hypocrisy and overturning the tables of the money changers. And so if you only have a segmented view even about that, it doesn't work very well. And I don't know about you, but I know I'm older than you, and I have found that oftentimes when I go to churches, the women's group is doing fine. They have the sort of steel magnolias ability to get together, work together, interact with one another, listen to each other, have empathy for one another. And oftentimes the men's part of that ministry is floundering. And even when they do get together, they're really kind of struggling with their own masculinity, and then wondering if their fathers, how they pass that on to their sons.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I love what you said about, you have the Jesus talking about, consider the lilies of the field and blessed are the poor in spirit and blessed are the meek. And then on the other hand, you do have the Jesus that overturns the tables in the temple. And, you know, I'm sure we can talk much more about Jesus, but I think in some people's experience, maybe you have an overemphasis on some of the more meek and mild, gentle and lowly aspects of Jesus's personality, at least in some of the places I was, that were influential for me growing up in the church spaces, and, you know, leaders that were really influential on me. I found sometimes the opposite was the case, where there was an overemphasis on Jesus as a warrior, or Jesus is angry, or Jesus as coming and crushing his enemies. And I feel like that can be an unhelpfully narrow view as well, where Jesus actually models a robust and nuanced understanding of what masculinity is, that I think can speak into extremes, perhaps, on both sides of how we underdefine, perhaps, and then on the other side, sometimes overdefine and get overly culturally specific in the way we think about masculinity when we're looking at Jesus.
Well, again, it looks like we'll solve that next hour, because we do have Dr. Ryan Dennison and Jim Dennison, because of their book is on the path to purpose, Christ's vision for your life, on the Sermon on the Mount. So we'll talk about the Beatitudes, and we'll talk about some of the aspects of that next hour. But we come back from the break, we're going to get into this in a little more detail. Zachary Wagner is the author and has really kind of taken you through all sorts of different aspects of how in which sometimes this has been communicated, sometimes within the church. And of course, we've been talking also about all the mixed messages, not only that we get inside the church, but outside the church. And I do feel for individuals that are struggling with this. So we'll come back and really try to dig into this in a little more detail. It is a book published by InterVarsity Press. It has come out more recently, and you can find out more about it on our website, pointofview.net. We'll be right back.
This is Viewpoints with Kirby Anderson.
Alex Berenson recently wrote about the First Freedom. He was on my radio program 4 years ago to talk about stories he was investigating after having left the New York Times. That was before he began reporting on topics related to the pandemic and vaccine that were considered forbidden. Perhaps now you can see why he writes about free speech. His faced social media censorship by merely reporting the truth about clinical trials about the vaccine. To make his point, he takes us back 82 years to a State of the Union speech given by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The president talked about four essential human freedoms. The second freedom was religious, the freedom of every person to worship God in his own way. The third was freedom from want, and the fourth was a freedom from fear. But the most important freedom, according to the president, was freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. This is the first freedom. This is the First Amendment. But Alex Berenson goes on to say that freedom of speech is essentially freedom of thought. If people can't say openly what they think, they will be forced into a shadow world. He goes on to explain, it doesn't matter whether the speech is right or wrong, objectively true or false. Indeed, the First Amendment makes no reference to the truth or falsity of the speech it protects. He is concerned that 70% now favor restricting false information online and isn't even sure the New York Times believes in the First Amendment. Twitter eventually banned him. One of his offenses was accurately reporting on the results of Pfizer's own clinical trial. You know, most Americans, including Democratic presidents, used to believe in free speech. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore. I'm Kirby Anderson, and that's my point of view.
For a free copy of Kirby's booklet, A Biblical View on Racism, go to viewpoints.info/racism. That's viewpoints.info/racism.
Have you noticed that it seems like we face new challenges every day? At the time of Jonah, the Bible says in Nineveh, they couldn't tell their right hand from their left. But in America today, some people have trouble telling the men from women. In fact, some say men can be women. As Christians, we are called to proclaim God's truth in every area of life. But who has time to study every crazy new thing the world comes up with? I'm glad you asked. You can get the information you need every day with the Viewpoints Commentary. This quick, easy read that is packed with solid, reliable information can be delivered to your email inbox every morning. To sign up to receive them, go to pointofview.net/viewpoints. That's pointofview.net/viewpoints. Viewpoints Commentaries with Kirby Anderson and Penna Dexter will help you make sense of the world around you. Once again, go to pointofview.net/viewpoints.
You're listening to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Zachary Wagner with us today as we talk about his book, Non-Toxic Masculinity, Recovering Healthy Male Sexuality. And first of all, Zachary, you've got a chapter talking about the dehumanization of men. What is toxic masculinity and where do we see it in the church? And one of the things you mention is just the poor models we have of male sexuality. I would add to that, they're just the poor models of masculinity in the first place, because inside the church, sometimes we don't talk about it. Or I've sometimes, when I talk to men, talk about the friendless American male, but to pastors oftentimes been told at a seminary, don't make friends with any of the men, because after all, you don't want to play favorites. So then they see this one man up there not having any male friends, saying, well, I don't need to have any male friends. He's not talking about his sexual issues, so I guess I shouldn't be talking about it. And as a result, that's in the church. Well, it gets really bad when you then go, and of course you mentioned Braveheart, or we could talk about James Bond films, we could talk about, you know, just about anything that is the case. And they, again, I feel sorry for a whole generation of young people whose role models sometimes are absent because of divorce from the home, absent in terms of any kind of good models in the church, and actually getting the worst possible models out there in the culture. So again, I think your book's right on target.
Yeah. And I in another interview that I was doing for this book, I was asked that question, what is the greatest challenge facing men or young men today? And what immediately came to mind, I hadn't like thought through like how would I answer that question if I had to boil it down to one thing, but what came to mind was friendlessness.
Yes.
This challenge of lack of robust relationships that can bear up under the stresses and the challenges of life, and people who can walk with you and suffer with you and encourage you and sharpen you and all of these things. And, you know, my book, as you alluded to, it focuses a lot on this question of male sexuality and the way that men in general, and then Christian men, sometimes sadly, tragically, struggle mightily as it relates to their sexuality and sexual sin and compulsive sexual behaviors with pornography, or remaining faithful to their partner, or remaining chaste and abstinent outside of marriage. And I do think these are actually related. I think the fact that men struggle to have any relational outlets can create a crisis internally, you know, psychologically, relationally, loss of purpose, any number of things that can tend to get, it can tend to manifest in a sexual way where men soothe their dark emotions or their lack of relational health in other ways through a sexual immaturity or sexual sin. I think those two are very much tied together. We can talk more, but I'd love to hear what else is on your mind and any other questions you have.
Well, you did talk about that because in some respects, a little bit later in the book, you talk about the fact that if you are going to pornography, addicted to pornography, it has some to do with sexuality, but it has a lot to do with a lot of other emotional needs and issues. So that's Absolutely. An important aspect of what you're trying to communicate in the book, I feel.
Yes, and I think there is, and this prevails a lot of times in the church, I think when, you know, so well-intentioned, we want to help young men, we want to help teenagers, we want to help older men, you know, have victory in this part of their life. But there can be a subtle way that we kind of adopt this cultural narrative where men are kind of out of control animals as it relates to their sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just part of being male, and it's inevitable, this kind of boys will be boys mentality, and men need sex and they can't possibly live without access to that. And I think we can sometimes dangerously baptize this kind of dehumanizing view of what it means to be a man, where we're not thinking about men as responsible moral agents or men who can be discipled into more mature ways of Christ-likeness as it relates to their sexuality. But we kind of think of like a hypersexual maleness as an inevitable, just an inevitability thing.
Yes.
So then as it relates to pornography, I think we say men, a lot of men, sometimes we even say all men struggle with pornography because that's just part of the male brain and that it becomes a struggle. And it then actually prevents us from asking the deeper questions about what is your story? What is your relational health in other areas of your life? What are your habits like?
Right.
What's your emotional wounds that pornography is in some way soothing you. It's helping you cope. So I think those are the deeper questions that for many men will lead to, you know, not immediately, but a path towards freedom beyond just this. This is every man's battle. Every man struggles with this, and you just got to get the right accountability structures in place. And of course, you know, I'm all for accountability structures in some sense, but I also want us to add to that, doing the hard work of growing up and maturing and developing our virtue into Christ-likeness.
By the way, you also quote from Kurt Thompson. He's been on the program many times about the desire.
Oh, wonderful.
And of course, you talk about to be male is to be hypersexual. And I think you're really knocking that down in a way that is helpful, because then it's kind of like, well, I can't control myself. Yes, you can.
Exactly.
And certainly. And again, since there's 15 chapters, we're going to keep the train moving down the road a little faster than I'd like, because you've talked not only about the dehumanization of men, but let's now talk about the dehumanization of women, because that really does get into it. I mean, I define toxic masculinity sometimes in one extreme, a man is withdrawn and sullen and all of that. But the other aspect, which is much more prevalent and well known, is misogyny, abuse, and those kinds of things. And even, again, as you talk about in that chapter, the over-sexualization of women. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it ties into what you said about, in response to the previous question, in that if this is an inevitable part of masculinity, this kind of hypersexual male, it can kind of give men, unintentionally, a free pass in their own minds, in the community's minds, in any number of ways when they act out in ways that are harmful to women. And that is really, really serious, it seems to me. And, you know, the broader cultural conversation around the Me Too movement, and then also this disturbing pattern that we saw emerge with hashtags and movements like Church Too. And, you know, we don't need to, but if you wanted to, you could rattle off just scandal after scandal of pastors who fall and really seriously harm women and children in this way. And, I say in the book, Christians didn't invent toxic masculinity. But we are responsible as the church to take very seriously and address when we see these dehumanizing patterns show up in Christian institutions, in communities, and in our context, and do the hard work of thinking through, is there a conception of masculinity underneath this pattern? Is there a new way of thinking about what it needs to be man, to be a man, that we need to disciple men and young men into, that insists on treating women as image bearers of God and treating them with dignity and respect, and holding ourselves as men to a standard to do that.
And again, I sometimes use David as an example when I'm speaking at a men's group or something like. The positive one is David and Jonathan, a covenant friendship, the kind of thing that was missing just a minute ago. And then, of course, we go to the one that everybody knows, and that's David and Bathsheba, because there, yep, you know, it's not just the sexuality, it's the power dynamic, because you don't Absolutely. Say no to a king. Well, in some of these churches, you, of course, name some names, and we have talked about these individuals before with Mary DeMuth and Piercy and all sorts of people over the years. But in some respects, there's a power dynamic. You're the senior pastor, and you're a woman that's a secretary in the choir, whatever. There is a sense in which there's a sexual element, but there's also a power dynamic too, isn't there?
There is, yeah. And I think that's the way certain sexual abuses can cross over into a type of, you know, quote unquote, spiritual abuse that can be doubly damaging, it seems to me, when someone is using their authority given by God to put people in a situation where it can feel like God is authorizing this mistreatment of this person and this abuse of this person. And that is really, really serious. And I believe God takes it seriously as well. And I think, I love the way that you highlight that it's not just David struggled with, you know, sexual sin as every man does, and he couldn't help himself with Bathsheba. I actually think that's not a good way to read that passage. I think he took advantage of and used his position of power to a selfish end. And I, in a certain way, many men, and I hesitate to say all men, but because of things like physical strength and size and the certain privileges that society affords to men, have that capacity to abuse that power if they so choose. And in the church, we need to be discipling men.
Let's take a break. We'll continue our conversation right after this.
There is an old military saying, if you don't have communications, you don't have anything. Good information is the key to success, not only for those in the military, but for all of us. You can't take positive, productive, and helpful action if you don't have good information. Point of View Radio's main role is to provide good information, and we distribute that information not only here through our radio program, but online and through our various social media channels. You know that big tech isn't exactly a supporter of what we do, so you need to take intentional steps to keep in touch with us. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at Point of View RTS, which of course stands for Point of View Radio Talk Show, at Point of View RTS. Also, make sure you follow us on Facebook, Point of View Radio Talk Show. We won't overwhelm you, usually just one post a day with information on our guests and what's important. The information you need when you need it. Point of View Radio Talk Show on Facebook and at Point of View RTS on Twitter. Point of View will continue after this.
USA News Update. Senator Mitt Romney, Republican of Utah and the 2012 Republican presidential nominee, announced yesterday that he would not be seeking re-election in 2024. Earlier this week, a Bahamas-flagged cruise ship, the MV Ocean Explorer, carrying about 206 people, ran aground in the world's northernmost national park in Greenland. There have been
Brighty on Radio and BrightyOnRadio.com.
This is an amazing company that has sponsored both of us. And this is a way to have backup communications when the grid goes down.
Well, the situation became problematic, Mike, with the New Orleans, the latest hurricane, because people panic. And this is one thing that I've learned from being associated with the satellite phone store for over a decade. People will call and order 600 phones at a time.
What?
It's like this, Mike. Anytime there is a crisis, people want these. And ladies and gentlemen, they've created such a good deal for Mike's viewers, my viewers, our combined viewers, that this is the only way you're going to be able to communicate.
And that's the other beauty about these phones, is they can't track you because it's not talking to a cell tower. It's talking to satellites, you know, orbiting over the equator. So SAT123.com, folks.
The U.S. prepares to bolster troops in Eastern Europe, and tensions build with Russia.
Secretary Austin has placed a range of units in the United States on a heightened preparedness to deploy, which increases our readiness to provide forces if NATO should activate the NRF, or if other situations develop.
We have been consulting with allies in deployments and refining plans for all scenarios. We've always said we would reinforce our allies on the eastern flank.
Stay up to date on Brighteon Radio.
Treasure Island coins and precious metals. Mike Adams of naturalnews.com says 2020 has shown us that we must prepare for the unexpected. Gold and silver will be indispensable to your fiscal well-being during the coming financial pandemic. Shipments are delivered safely, discreetly, and securely right to your door. A precious metals IRA allows you to protect your retirement savings with the ultimate safe haven, assets of gold and silver. Gold and silver will be indispensable to your financial well-being. Your metals are held in the form of real coins and bars in an actual depository under your name and on your behalf. Simply visit BrighteonMetals.com today. Gold and silver will be indispensable to your financial well-being. Shouldn't you at least look into it? Treasure Island coins and precious metals. We're here to help. Visit BrighteonMetals.com today.
Take a stand against biased talk radio.
I'm going to take a strong stand against it.
And listen to Brighteon Radio, where we give you both sides of the story.
Thanks for your support of this platform. Use the code BTV at checkout for additional savings. BrighteonStore.com.
Brighteon Radio and BrighteonRadio.com.
The Truth Team is the core support group that keeps Point of View's voice strong. Your support will make it possible to bring reliable truth and information to listeners across the nation. Get all the details today, right now, by visiting pointofview.net/team. Make an investment in a great future. Make an investment in truth. Pointofview.net/team and 1-800-347-5151.
Are listening to Point of View. The opinions expressed on Point of View do not necessarily reflect the views of the management or staff of this station. And now, here again is Kirby Anderson.
Continue our conversation today with Zachary Wagner, Non-Toxic Masculinity, Recovering Healthy Male Sexuality. It is published by InterVarsity Press. Of course, you could probably find it in your local bookstore, but we have information about it on our website if you'd like to order it. And again, we're going to open up the phones if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment. 800-351-1212. I suspect you're probably just going to sit back and take some notes, but if you'd like to join us, that is the case. Next hour, we'll have a lot more kind of discussion about some very important issues in the news, as well as, of course, our conversation with Dr. Ryan Dennison. So we'll get into all of that in just a few minutes. But Zachary, up until now, we said, okay, here's the problem. Okay, yeah. Smart guys, do you have any solutions? And that's in the Renewed Vision of Male Sexuality. And your chapter, especially about Jesus as the true man, reminded me of the conversation we had yesterday with Dr. Carmen Joy Imes, who is a professor at Biola, or and also at Talbot. Her book on being God's image, although we spent some time in Genesis, we also talked about Jesus as the ideal human. And in a sense, what you do in this particular chapter is talk about Jesus as the ideal in a male body. Can you explain?
Yeah, well, I think there is a sense, particularly with all the negative messages that men so often receive about masculinity in our culture. And then as it relates to, you know, bringing it back to this question of sexuality, I think a lot of men can feel very broken as it relates to their sexuality. They can have a lot of guilt and shame and even self-hatred, I think, towards that part of themselves. But what we learn from Jesus, not just that he's the ideal human being, but that he is a human in a male body, we have this wonderful message to men and young men and boys that created embodied maleness is a good and wonderful thing. And it is not something that was so broken or fragmented that God, the Son, could not take on form as a human being. And then in Jesus's own life, we have wonderful example to follow of a man who lived in love to all people, but also, you know, bringing it back to this cultural conversation, in respect to women and in beautiful relationship with women that he was not married to, you know, and was able to be in relationship and loving friendship with. I think there's so much that we can learn from Jesus in this regard, and a lot of correctives kind of to both of the extremes, I think, that we were talking about earlier.
Well, again, as I was reading that particular chapter, I was thinking I probably would quote the book of Hebrews. I turned over, and there it is. Jesus was like us in every way, yet he did not sin.
Exactly. And I think because Jesus is truly human, you know, he was like us in every way. The word become flesh, but he did not sin. There's this incredible thing where Jesus is actually not less human than us. He is more human than us. He is the most human being who has ever lived because he never yielded to that dehumanizing force of sin that all of us have in various ways yielded to. So he then becomes this perfect example, not just to become like God, but to become what human beings were made to be all along.
And again, you talk about this idea of time to grow up, which, of course, is an introduction into your whole section at the end, growing up and becoming a man. But just before we do so, while we're talking about Jesus as the model, let's back up a chapter, because you did talk about some of the misconceptions which we're sharing, spreading, promoting sometimes within the church. And it does seem to me that that's another reason why you wrote this book.
Yeah, it does. And I think we need to look at two places, it seems to me. Look at Jesus, as we've already said, but also look carefully at Scripture. What does Scripture say and not say about what it means to be a man? And I think so often, if we're not careful, and this is a problem for all of us, it seems to me, when we come to the Bible, we bring our own assumptions about masculinity, bring our own assumptions from our culture, and rather are coming to it with a posture of, well, I know what's here and I know what God says about this, rather than having that humble posture of being willing to hear and be challenged by what we see in the Word. And I think that is so important on this question of masculinity.
One of the things I do appreciate is that we well know that throughout Scripture, there are a lot of stories that don't end well. And I mentioned David just a minute ago, but then you counterpose that with two biblical men, of course, David and Bathsheba, but then, of course, Joseph and Potiphar's wife. And it does seem to me that as helpful as it is in Scripture to have those times of failing, to recognize that all of sin falls short of the glory of God, there are certain very positive examples, and Joseph is one. You can think of Daniel as another. There's a few individuals that also say you don't have to accept or be resigned to the idea that I have no possibility of victory over sin.
Yeah, that's right. And I think so often for me growing up, David is used, and it's a cautionary tale, but used as a cautionary tale to say any man can be susceptible to sexual sin. And, you know, of course, we do need to watch carefully if we're standing lest we fall. But on this question, I just directing my attention to Joseph, and Joseph is a young man where the power dynamic is flipped from what we actually discussed with David and Bathsheba, where Potiphar's wife is in the position of power over Joseph.
Very good.
And she propositions him, but what he says to her is so beautiful. He says, I cannot do this because it would be a great sin against God. He doesn't even bring Potiphar into it, or this would be inappropriate, or this would be a sin against my master. He puts, I think, the focus right where it needs to be on his relationship with God. and that yielding to this advance from this woman would be a sin against God.
Let's, McCann, get into your last section, because it's growing up, becoming a man, and you've divided it into, of course, boyhood and adolescence and then singleness and those kinds of issues, because in some respects, to have a proper understanding, a biblical understanding of sexuality begins at a very young age. And we've talked about this before. Some people say, when do you have the talk? Well, don't wait till they're teenagers. You have, quote, the talk. You just give as much information as you can the first time they notice that there's a difference between boys and girls or something of that nature, because that is what you call the proper and biblical formation of male sexuality.
Yes, and I think having age-appropriate conversations at every stage of childhood to adolescence that begin to sow the seeds of a God-honoring expression of male sexuality. It includes it's good and beautiful, and Jesus had a body like yours as well. And as a man, you are called to respect and honor those around you, women and men. And those messages are not over a young child's head. They're not over a little boy's head, but they will have application as he grows up and comes into more awareness of his kind of sexual erotic self later on. And we can start forming men into Christ-likeness early, it seems to me.
Well, and again, the sad reality is, and I've talked about this for years, but of course we've had people from Pure Hope on as well, the median age of first exposure to pornography, which used to be, at least in my generation, more something around the teen years, is happening younger and younger. As a matter of fact, I remember when I first wrote a chapter in one of the books on Christian ethics back in the 1980s about pornography, talked about going to a particular part in town where you probably wouldn't want to go. Well, of course, by the time I was writing one in the 1990s or refurbishing that chapter, we're talking about the fact that the internet became the ultimate brown wrapper. And so now young people are seeing pornography. But as you get into your other chapter on adolescence, this whole idea of porn and adolescence and sexual temptation is a really big issue that parents are going to have to address.
Yeah, and it was a huge part of my story as well. I think the rise of high-speed internet and then the smartphone, oh my goodness, where we went from, you know, as you're talking from your generation, we kind of had to go down the street, or, you know, maybe you found your dad's stash or your uncle's stash or whatever the case may be. You really had to go look for it oftentimes. Now it's just in your pocket. And that is a massive challenge, it seems to me.
Yes, it is.
And we need to be countering the messages, the way pornography shapes not just young men, but also young women and their brains to have certain ideas around what sexuality is and what it's for. And we can't be passive and just kind of hoping to avoid it and hoping to not have those conversations. I do think parents and leaders and teachers need to be willing to step in the space of countering those messages early, and also walking with young people in the confusion and shame when they do stumble across pornography or even seek it out intentionally.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll spend just a few more minutes with Zachary Wagner. If you've just joined us, we're talking about this book, Non-Toxic Masculinity, Recovering Healthy Male Sexuality, is published by InterVarsity Press. As I mentioned, 15 chapters, 200 pages, great material. We'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about, okay, once we maybe make our way past the teen years, adolescence, we're still talking about dating and romance, singleness, some really important issues there as well. I also want to talk about how this book could be used. Of course, you could read it individually, but I know many of you have small groups. Might be with something you'd like to go through as a group. So we'll talk about that with Zachary right after this.
Do you ever see things on the news and say to yourself, what universe is this person living in? A person's worldview, their assumptions about life and how we got here, lead to conclusions that don't often match up with God's reality. But there's an even deeper problem. A recent study found it's not just them, it's us. Just 9% of those claiming to be Christians live life consistently with biblically based beliefs. What's the solution? Better information, real news. And that's what millions of people get every day with Point of View. Equip Americans to turn our nation back to God and His truth. Learn more at pointofview.net or call 1-800-347-5151. Join the Truth Team today, pointofview.net and 800-347-5151.
The recent release of the Centers for Disease Control's biannual Youth Risk Behavior Survey has sparked discussion about the role social media plays in the substantial rise of mental illness among young people. Prominent researchers have conducted hundreds of studies on the influence of screen-based activities on teen mental health, mostly reporting only small effects. Mindful of social media's drain on teens' sleep, exercise, and family time, social scientist and author Jonathan Haidt dug deeper. He recruited psychology professor Gene Twenge, and the two began compiling all relevant studies and found that, indeed, digital media, which encompasses all screen-based activities, had only a small correlation to the rise in anxiety and depression among teens. But the story is very different when you zoom in exclusively on social media. The relationship between social media use and mental illness is between 2 and 6 times larger than for all digital media. The most pronounced damage is to girls. The CDC survey found 57% of teen girls reporting persistent sadness or hopelessness. This is up from 36% in 2011. 30% say they have seriously considered suicide, up from 19% in 2011. Professor Haidt explains the teen mental health epidemic's sudden onset, which occurred in 2012, the year Facebook bought Instagram. Instagram was founded in 2010, the same year Apple released the iPhone 4, the first smartphone with a front-facing camera. Soon, in multiple countries, most teens were spending less time with friends, and most girls were spending hours per week trying to perfect their Instagram profiles. Parents can't fix this by forbidding the use of social media. Social media, says Professor Haidt, transforms social life for everyone, even those who don't use social media. Social media isolates teens, but taking the phone away also isolates them from their entire community. They've been rewired. For Point of View, I'm Penna Dexter.
Listening to Point of View, your listener-supported source for truth.
Back for a few more minutes with Zachary Wagner. Again, he is an individual that is right now receiving and working on his Doctor of Philosophy in New Testament Studies at the University of Oxford. And this is his first book and is an individual that you may want to know more about. We do have a link to the website. We'll talk about that in just a minute. The book, in case you're wondering, is called Non-Toxic Masculinity, Recovering Healthy Male Sexuality. And Zachary, we've certainly made our way through young people and even teenagers, but there's a whole section you have on dating, romance, and extended singleness. And again, since I've written about this, you can see that the median age of first marriage since the 1960s has increased a full 8 years, both for men and women. And so the difference, especially if you go back, say, a whole century or two, the 19th century, there are people who were getting married in their teen years. And so just about the time they had even maybe sexual interest in the opposite sex, they were getting married. Now you've got this enormously long period of time, which could extend forever in terms of, as you call, extended singleness. And so when we're dealing with this issue of sexuality and toxic masculinity, it's a bigger problem than it's ever been in the history of the world.
Yes. Yeah. And I think there are, you know, there's been shifts both in preference for when people get married, but I also think genuine pressures having to do with finances and finishing college and all numbers of things. So a lot of that, if I'm honest, feels like it's above my pay grade. But what we do see in scripture is examples of righteous singleness that extends well into adulthood. There are conversations about you know, it's not wrong to desire to get married. Marriage is a beautiful thing, blessed by God and ordained by God even. But just, again, going back to the Lord Jesus and the Apostle Paul, we have examples of, you know, you can live as a righteous and godly man even as a single person. And perhaps men may have to do that longer than they would like today. And women, certainly. I mean, another dynamic here that we could spend a lot of time on, we won't go into in detail, is the fact that there are more women in the church who want to be married than there are men who are actively pursuing
very
marriage.
True. And that's going to bring that up. Yeah, that's
challenges.
I mean, we all anecdotally know some wonderful women who we'd like to pair up with a nice man, but we can't find them. And statistically, I think you can prove that as well. And so that is another issue to just, in some respects, speak that from the pulpit and also address that issue, because as you're pointing out, this is something that sometimes the church didn't know how to handle. We used to have, in some churches, we hardly even had a singles group. It was just the college group, and then it was maybe the career group, and then eventually we had singles again. And, you know, the church over time has had to kind of come to grips with some really significant social and economic trends that have really changed the dynamic. And so, again, you're at all is actually really addressing that in the book as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think encouraging, you know, there was a movement in, you know, the late 90s when I was growing up and early into the 2000s, kind of against rejecting kind of cultural categories of dating. Yes. And to some extent, I think we're back to like, no, like marriage is good. Like you can pursue marriage. And like that, it's almost the opposite challenge, it seems to me, that we're facing with young people today.
So what would you say, since you do have a chapter here about maturing the church's culture of masculine sexuality? I mean, I know that, of course, you are already involved in the Center for Pastoral Theologians. And certainly I want you to maybe speak for just a few minutes, if you might, to pastors, small group leaders, Sunday school teachers, life group leaders, and others, because it seems to me that, as you point out, we've had the Me Too movement, we've had the Church Two movement, we've had all sorts of dynamics, and these, I think, are issues that should be addressed from the pulpit. These are issues I think should be addressed in Sunday school sessions, maybe not always from the pulpit every time, but there's some ways in which we could begin to address some very important issues about the objectification of women, about abuse. Speak to that if you might.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. First, in what is said from the pulpit, I think pastors in this kind of new post Me Too world, helpfully what that movement has highlighted is the ways that culture broadly has kind of baked into it this attitudes of violence and dehumanization against women too often. I think that can infect the church as well. So pastors, be very aware of the ways that you're talking about women, women's bodies, and then also male and male sexuality. You know, something I have to talk about is that sometimes in the church we can over-sexualize, if we're not careful, women's bodies. And then we can also over-sexualize men